Before we get to the show, we're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we need your help. As a listener of the world, you know the value of our journalism. Now is the time to step up and support it. Make a donation today at theworld.org/match to double your impact. That's theworld.org/match. Thank you. Talks between the U.S. and North Korea are stalled, and Kim Jong-un promises a Christmas gift of more missile launches.
When North Korea makes those types of threats, they usually keep them.
Also today, new investigations show tainted water up north.
Hundreds of communities in Canada actually have worse levels of lead than in Flint, Michigan, during the height of the water crisis.
And do you ever think, should I go to my high school reunion or just skip it? For the class of 77 from one school in Tehran, reuniting in California was a no-brainer.
These people are the most important ones in my life, like sisters and brothers,
yeah.
And it was amazing. Now it is more amazing.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. She's a 19-year-old who fled Honduras. She's pregnant, and when she crosses into the U.S., her contractions begin. She turns herself into Border Patrol agents. They take away her phone and wait outside her hospital room. The baby is born with complications and is taken away from her mother. This is the story of a teenage mom who's been in Chula Vista, California since last week. What happened next, she told her attorney, is even more frightening.
She asked the agent when she was going to be able to see her child, and they told her that she wasn't going to be able to see the baby and that she would be taken back to Border Patrol custody and returned to Mexico.
That's Erica Pinheiro. She's an attorney advocating on behalf of the mother, whose name has not been released publicly. Pinheiro directs litigation for the immigrant rights group Al Otro Lado.
Saturday night, we received a call from within the hospital saying that a 19-year-old asylum seeker had just given birth to a U.S. citizen child and was being threatened by Border Patrol with separation from her child. So our office sent a team of attorneys on Sunday morning to the hospital to try to talk with the 19-year-old mother. And unfortunately, Border Patrol had several officers stationed outside of her room and would not let us speak to the client. So it wasn't until yesterday that we were actually able to speak with her and confirm that she actually had been threatened with separation.
And when you spoke with her yesterday, what did she sound like?
The first thing that struck me was how childlike her voice was. You know, she's barely an adult herself. The other thing that struck me was just how committed she was to staying with her child. I feel that she maybe wasn't understanding a lot of the questions I was asking her about her immigration history and what had happened at the border, because she just kept answering, you know, I'm staying with my baby. I want your help. You know, the baby's having trouble breathing, and was just very focused on the well-being of her child. The other thing that really struck me is just how brave she was in insisting that she speak to an attorney. I mean, this is a 19-year-old woman, and when she was told that she would be separated, she insisted on speaking to counsel and tried to find anyone she could to help her.
Bottom line, for the near term for this mother, U.S. officials were going to send her to Mexico while the baby would remain in the U.S.
Yeah, so there's actually probably dozens of cases like this every month along the U.S. border. And we're not entirely sure of the exact scope of the problem because most of it's done in secret. But we've seen documented several other cases in Texas where women are giving birth in Border Patrol or ICE custody and have the child removed from them immediately after giving birth.
So it seems U.S. officials have reversed course in this case of the 19-year-old woman, and they say the newborn and the mom won't be separated. And will they both remain in the U.S.?
Right now, they are being allowed to remain in the United States. So the woman will be able to go through her asylum proceeding outside of custody. Right now, I know her primary concern is the well-being of her baby, who remains hospitalized.
Why do you think, in this case, the mother and child have been permitted to stay in the U.S.? I mean, that's what it looks like for the near term anyway.
I believe it was because of the media coverage. When we got the call about the potential separation and we went to the hospital, as I mentioned, we weren't allowed to see the client, and we called some local journalists who thankfully answered the call and came to the hospital. One of them captured a photo of Border Patrol agents carrying a very small child car seat into the hospital. And once that photo went out to the world, there was a lot of outrage, especially locally, and a lot of advocates and even elected officials calling to help us. And so I think really the public outrage from that photo helped reverse course in the situation.
In this case of this 19-year-old Honduran woman, had the separation happened with her child, would the mother ever have had any recourse?
Technically, there is the Hague Convention, which is supposed to protect parental rights when parent and child are from different countries. That law specifically was meant to address a lot of the fraudulent adoptions that were happening decades ago, especially in Guatemala, but throughout the developing world. But practically, it's almost impossible for a parent to vindicate their parental rights if they are not in the United States. One, because they need an attorney. Most people can't afford to pay an attorney. But even when you have an attorney, there's a prejudice against deported parents amongst family law judges in the United States. And I've seen this time and time again in working with deportees. You know, family law judges are very reluctant to send a U.S. citizen child to Mexico or other developing countries. I believe that had she been returned to Mexico, it would have been difficult to impossible for her to ever see her baby again.
When this happens, how high is the risk that the newborn will be adopted without the mother's consent?
I think it's a pretty high risk. I would say the risk is much higher for adoption without the parents' consent than it was in the mass of family separation cases we saw last year.
Erica Pinheiro is an attorney with the immigrant advocacy group Al Otro Lado. She's been speaking with us from Tijuana. Erica, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
We reached out to Customs and Border Protection for their side of the story. CBP spokesperson Ralph DeCio responded via email. He confirmed that Border Patrol agents had arrested the pregnant 19-year-old from Honduras after she illegally entered the United States. DeCio also wrote that, quote, all aliens that enter the United States illegally are subject to deportation. And he added that, due to privacy issues, nothing more can be provided related to this specific matter. Let's get this done. That's a quote from the U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea, Stephen Biegun. He was on a visit to South Korea and wanted to send a message directly to his North Korean counterparts. Nuclear talks between the U.S. and North Korea have been stalled for months. Biegun wants them back on track. Meanwhile, Kim's military has carried out a series of provocative weapons tests, and now North Korea is threatening more. As if all of this wasn't problematic enough, the U.S.-South Korean alliance is coming under strain, as Jason Strother reports now from Seoul.
In typically cryptic fashion, North Korea says it might have a Christmas gift for the United States. The North blames Washington for stalled talks and says the U.S. must make more concessions to restart negotiations.
Well, when North Korea makes those types of threats, they usually keep them.
That's Chun In-bum. He's a retired South Korean general.
So I would not be surprised if on Christmas morning, instead of Santa Claus, we see a rocket, you know, flashing through the air.
Testing a long-range rocket would be a provocative move. But Chun says even if North Korea does launch an ICBM around Christmas, he's not worried that President Trump will react the same way he did 2 years ago with his own threats of total annihilation.
I believe Mr. Trump is now more aware that he has other options than fire and fury that will be more effective. Hopefully he will not resort to that unless North Korea makes a direct military attack against the territories of the United States or its allies in South Korea and Japan.
But Chun says there's tension between the U.S. and its allies. The Trump administration is reportedly asking Seoul for $5 billion annually to host American forces here. That's five times what South Korea currently pays. The way the White House sees it, it's the U.S. that protects the Republic of Korea, the South's official name, from the North. Trump says South Korea is a rich country, so the implication is it should pay a lot more for that American security. General Chun says this transactional approach goes against the spirit of the alliance.
The way the Trump administration is presenting the cost-sharing issue is hurting the alliance. Both the United States and the Republic of Korea benefit from the alliance. And by making it to dollars and cents, you know, it just transforms that concept.
South Koreans overwhelmingly support the alliance with the U.S. But a solid majority oppose such a steep increase in defense cost-sharing, according to a recent survey. And there's a vocal minority that says South Korea shouldn't pay anything. Around 200 demonstrators protest outside the building where U.S. and South Korean envoys are trying to work out a deal ahead of the end-of-year deadline. Park Jung-un was one of the protest's organizers. She told me later that she doesn't buy the argument that the U.S. keeps South Korea safe.
북한의 위협이라고 하는 게 꼭 미국만 향하고 있다고 생각하는 건 아니다.
Park said that, yes, North Korea is a threat to South Korea's security, but the U.S. military is a threat too. That's because American forces could trigger retaliation from the North, and that could lead to war. The dispute over cost-sharing between the U.S. and South Korea is welcome news to North Korea's closest ally. That's according to John Delery at Yonsei University in Seoul.
China's fundamental interest is to see the U.S. security role in East Asia diminish. And so this serious tension in the U.S.-South Korea alliance is a good thing. They're probably sitting back and smiling and trying to stay quiet and hope those tensions just keep working the magic from a Chinese perspective.
In downtown Seoul, there was another protest today across from the U.S. Embassy. One group of demonstrators tore apart a giant American flag. It was pretty clear how people here felt about President Trump's demand for more security spending. Chang Yu-jin introduced herself as a university student. She told the crowd the U.S. is a thief, asking for money for Korean land. The U.S. military needs to get out of Korea, she said. We don't need them here. Over the loudspeakers, there was a song that seems to have been written just for this occasion. The lyrics go, "Why do you act like you own this land? We are the owners." For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
With the holidays upon us, we all have to figure out the best way to spend our gift money. Here's an idea that could deliver some bang for your buck, a chance to win an original Picasso for just 100 euros, about $110.
I thought Picasso could be a good gift to have in a lottery. So I called the family, Picasso family, and they said, yes, this could be a great idea. Why not?
Perry Cochin created a raffle called One Picasso for 100 euros. She wanted to raise money for a charity in a creative way and has known the Picasso family for decades. That helps. Cochin also had ideas about which Picasso should be raffled off. It had to be signed by Picasso on the front to start with.
Pablo Picasso didn't sign every single painting he did. He used to sign them only when they were sold. And when he died, he left behind him a huge amount of paintings that are not signed.
Cochin also wanted the painting to be colorful, and it had to appeal to everyone, nothing too sexual, because anyone around the world could win it. This year's Picasso is titled Nature Morte. It's a 1921 still life of a newspaper and a glass of absinthe, valued at more than $1 million. Go to our Instagram page to see the painting. We're at PRI The World. If you think it may look nice in your home, put your name in the hat. There are 200,000 raffle tickets available online. At about $110 each, Cochin could raise more than $22 million for charity.
This money that we are raising will go specifically to Africa to bring clean water in three countries, Madagascar, Cameroon, and Morocco. This will help more than 200,000 persons.
This is the second edition of One Picasso for 100 euros. In 2013, a 25-year-old man from Pennsylvania won the raffle. Back then, I asked Olivier Picasso, the artist's grandson, if his grandfather would be okay with raffling off his work.
Being someone who cared a lot about his family, about friends, and about political causes, I'm sure that giving away something to help people would have been something natural. So I'm sure he would have been proud and ready to do it.
The raffle drawing will be held on January 9th in Paris. Organizers plan to raffle off another Picasso next year as well. As the lottery pundits say, hey, you never know. As a listener of The World, you know that our journalists bring new perspectives and insights to issues like climate change. Just this year, reporter Carolyn Beeler spent 2 months on an expedition to Antarctica, studying the effects of climate change and reporting for The World. Shirin Jafari took us inside Saudi Arabia to report on the changing role of women there and barriers to those changes. Producer Daniel Offman and I traveled to Russia to meet young people who love Vladimir Putin and others who organize in opposition to him. Not every newsroom would invest in this kind of reporting, but we do. If you value in-depth, on-the-ground journalism that brings you right into the story, then step up and support it today. A gift of any size makes a difference, but if you donate $60 today, that will be doubled to $120. Just visit theworld.org/match. Thanks very much. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Your high school reunion, the idea might stir all kinds of feelings, anxiety, curiosity, joy. How are you? This high school reunion is one that the alumni really wanted to make happen. They gathered at a Los Angeles country club, 7,500 miles from their high school. They graduated in Tehran in 1977. Just as his class was coming of age, Iran was gripped by revolutionary riots. The Islamic Revolution toppled a government 2 years after the students graduated. And now the class of 77 is finally reconnecting at their first high school reunion in 42 years. Reporter Asal Asanapur joined the party in L.A.
Hey, baby. How are you?
In some ways, this is just your typical high school reunion. This guy has just caught a glimpse of his very first crush.
Oh, she's right there, with a white dress. She's beautiful. She hasn't changed.
And before I could get his name, he's off to profess his love. All of these partygoers attended Etifag, an Iranian Jewish school that spanned kindergarten through 12th grade. And full disclosure, I know about it because my mom went there for high school. In Farsi, Be'etifag means together. And that togetherness is what people are celebrating tonight, regardless of how much time has passed, where they live, or their religion.
I'm actually a good example of that.
Mandana Vasek is one of the reunion organizers living in L.A. She's Muslim, but she says that in a country where Jews and Muslims rarely integrated, Etifag was a place where all of that didn't matter.
I even carried the Torah and morning prayers when we went to the temple, you know. It was just my love and passion for my friends. I never thought of them being Jewish or Muslim or rich or poor. We were just friends.
The school in Iran reflected the country's religious minorities, like Christians, Baha'is, and Zoroastrians. The curriculum was rigorous, and it was a rare co-ed school in Iran, which women like Mariam Aryan tell me inspired them to pursue powerhouse careers.
Men and women were raised side by side with the same level of expectation. Just because we were a woman, we weren't granted this pass that, oh, you're going to get married. We were very competitive and very studious.
And so students say the school was a microcosm of Iran at the time, diverse, egalitarian, and free. Most of the people at this reunion left Iran and now live here in L.A. or other parts of the U.S., but some people never left. One woman here, a doctor, still lives in Iran and flew out for the reunion. She didn't want to use her name because it can be dangerous in Iran for people to talk to Western media.
Tell me why it was important for you to come all this way from Iran to be here.
Because I think that these people are the most important ones in my life, like sisters and brothers,
yeah.
And it was amazing. Now it is more amazing.
The doctor lost contact with a lot of friends after graduation, but she got back in touch recently when her classmate Mori Shimouni started a WhatsApp group. Within days, he tracked down the entire class of 77. Like many Jewish people in the group, Maurice left Iran for fear of religious persecution.
When I left Iran in 1977, if you would have told me that in 42 years I will be living in the United States, having my own business, even have a family here, I would have laughed.
Today, Maurice lives in L.A., but he still carries the memory of the streets where he used to play soccer and the people from the corner store where he'd pick up groceries for his mom. But the Iran of today is unrecognizable, and so is Etefagh. It's still a Jewish school, but it's all girls and government-run. Morris says that in a way, this reunion is the closest thing to going back in time.
We are still living with the memory of what we experienced then, and today actually is just a celebration of that memory.
A memory that they're celebrating together, be'etefagh. But the word etefagh also translates to something that happened, like their lives before the revolution, before kids and grandkids, before scattering around the world. For The World, Asal Asanapour, Los Angeles.
Juicy fruit it ain't, but there was gum in olden times. In fact, about 6,000 years ago, a young woman in what is now southern Denmark tossed a lump of chewing gum made from birch tar into a shallow lagoon. Fast forward to the present, some researchers who found the gum during an excavation have used it to reassemble the woman's entire genetic code. Hanne Schroeder is a molecular anthropologist and associate professor at the University of Copenhagen. He's one of the researchers who studied the ancient gum. What does this DNA actually tell you? What did this young woman look like?
We found out that the individual who chewed this piece of birch pitch was female, that this person who lived about 5,700 years ago in Denmark, southern Denmark, had this striking combination of dark skin and dark hair and blue eyes that was fairly common in Stone Age Europe at that time. We found that she was more closely related genetically to what we call Western hunter-gatherers from continental Europe than to hunter-gatherers who live just a few hundred kilometers further to the north in central Scandinavia and Sweden, who have another type of admixture, and she didn't have that. So that tells us something about how southern Scandinavia was first settled by humans. So yeah, you can get a lot from a single genome.
Well, let's get back to this gum part of the story. What is birch tar?
Right. So birch pitch, or birch tar, as you say, it's a black-brown substance that's produced by heating up birch bark. And then you obtain this, yeah, resinous kind of substance, and that solidifies on cooling. But then, you know, it can be made malleable again by chewing it. And we know by the fact that often these pieces of birch pitch are found with tooth imprints, they were indeed chewed. And then they would have been used for hafting stone tools, for instance. So, you know, if you have an arrow shaft, for instance, a wooden one, and you want to put an arrowhead made of stone on that arrow, then you would use this substance in order to haft the stone arrowhead onto the arrow shaft, and the same with, you know, other types of tools and implements. So yeah, it was kind of like a all-purpose glue, if you want.
Yeah, so kind of an adhesive. I mean, what did this wad of gum look like when you found it, and how'd you figure out it was something akin to modern chewing gum?
They're really inconspicuous. So they're really small lumps, maybe a centimeter and a half in size. And often they're found with tooth imprints, but this one didn't have any tooth imprints, but it has all the other hallmarks of chewing gum. So these folds and things that you can see. And so, you know, and then we just thought, okay, well, maybe there's DNA in there. And we tried, and yeah, lo and behold, we got a complete ancient human genome out of it, which was, you know, quite astonishing.
Mm. And it wasn't stuck on the bottom of some ancient shoe, was it?
No, it was just found in that site.
The fact that you are extracting valuable information from a 6,000-year-old piece of gum, does it also open up the possibility that there are other things you haven't thought of yet that might contain ancient DNA?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, actually, well, earlier this year, we published a paper where we got ancient DNA from, you know, not quite that old, only 200-300 years old, from a pipe stem in Maryland. You know, we could tell a lot about that individual's ancestry and so on just from that DNA. But yeah, I mean, there are probably other types of objects that we might be able to get human DNA from, and possibly even, you know, microbial DNA, as in this case. But, you know, having said that, you know, these objects are quite special. So, you know, due to the fact that they were chewed, and this was kind of part of the tool-making process. So that means that we have a chance of recovering this human DNA and also the microbial DNA, which might not be the case with, you know, other types of objects.
Hanne Schroeder is a molecular anthropologist at the University of Copenhagen. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Boeing is halting production of the 737 MAX. The impact is profound, and not just on Boeing.
The most important thing we don't know is what they're going to tell the supply chain. The supply chain is responsible for about 80% of the value of this aircraft.
The ripple effect of grounding America's biggest export. I'm Marco Werman. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. U.S. forces have been in Afghanistan since 2001, nearly two decades, America's longest war, and no end in sight. We now know that the upbeat accounts that officials related to us about how the war was going did not reflect what was really going on there, and in some cases were outright lies. It's easy to tune out Afghanistan, but for Afghans and U.S. troops, that's not an option. Almost every day, the Taliban or other extremist groups are launching attacks. We want to step back as a way to not lose sight of what's really going on there. The World's Shirin Jafari joins me. So lay it out. What do we need to know 18 years into this war in Afghanistan?
Okay, there is a lot going on, of course, in Afghanistan, but I thought I would just focus on two major news topics, the Afghan presidential election and the peace talks.
Sounds good. All right, let's start with the elections.
Okay, Afghanistan held the presidential election back in September. So it's been almost 3 months since Afghans went to the polls. But so far, there is no winner. And the reason is that there's a dispute between the two leading candidates about some of the votes that were cast in some of the provinces. And Marco, just to give you a little background here, since the U.S. invasion in 2001, presidential elections in Afghanistan have been contentious. Often the candidates accuse the other side of vote rigging and fraud. For example, in 2014, the last time Afghans held an election, there were disputes about the outcome.
Right, I remember that. The U.S. had to actually step in, right?
Yeah, they stepped in and they brokered a power-sharing government between the two leading candidates, Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani. That didn't really work out as expected either, because Abdullah Abdullah claims that when Ghani got into power, he sort of sidelined Abdullah and he has been in total control ever since.
So again, this year, 2019, Afghans are having trouble with their election. They're still waiting to find out who their next president is. So what's different this time around?
So this year, in order to improve the voting system and to minimize any fraud, the Afghans had a new system in place. That system uses biometric data like fingerprints, and it uses headshots of the voters, and it indicates the date and time that the vote was cast. But it turns out that didn't work out either, because reports say some 100,000 votes have been cast outside the voting hours. And that's why the Afghan Election Commission hasn't been able to announce a final winner in this race.
So that's in the air. In the meantime, there are peace talks, right? A U.S. delegation is negotiating a peace deal with the Taliban.
Yeah, and all of this goes to show how complicated and fragile the situation in Afghanistan is at this moment. We know that U.S. Representative Zalmay Khalilzad has met with Taliban representatives in the past few days, and he's sort of picking up where he left off. You might remember, Marco, that earlier this fall, the peace talks were really heating up to the point that President Trump hinted several times that the deal is imminent. He even invited the Taliban leaders to Camp David for the announcement just before the anniversary of 9/11.
Right.
But then Trump suddenly canceled the invitation and he said the talks were off.
So how do the talks look now?
Well, the Taliban hasn't committed to reducing violence. Just last week, they carried out a suicide attack near a major U.S. military base in Afghanistan. Two Afghans died and about 70 people were injured. And U.S. Representative Zalmay Khalilzad said that he is putting the negotiations on pause until the Taliban consult their leadership about reducing violence.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thanks very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
Until there is meaningful peace in Afghanistan, we'll continue to see people leaving the country. Afghans fleeing the war make up one of the largest groups of asylum seekers in the world. Europe continues to be their primary destination of choice. Many go by boat, making the treacherous journey from Turkey to the Greek islands like Lesbos. Those islands are now seeing a spike in arrivals for the first time in years. Greece has responded by vowing to shut down its overcrowded refugee camps on Lesbos, including the most famous one, including the most infamous one, Moria. Holly Young recently met an Afghan refugee who started a school in Moria.
Yeah.
Zakaria Farzad has built a school high up on the hill of an olive grove. We walk about 5 minutes up some slippery ground before we see the boxy one-story structure, made from wood and blue and white tarpaulins.
Maruf, the principal of this room.
Nice to meet you. Zakaria's colleagues are busy building the front porch of a new classroom. Patterned rugs are laid out on the floor in front of a whiteboard.
Then we have German language classes, French, Arabic, Farsi, English, lots of different levels. We have music classes, guitar classes.
This school that Zakaria has built is in the middle of Moria, Europe's most notorious refugee camp on the island of Lesvos.
So this is the main classroom, the main building.
This is one of our classrooms.
Zakaria is 40 and a journalist back in Afghanistan. With a few friends, he pulled together money and found some people in Moria who were willing to teach. What started as classes in the open air now has over 1,000 students.
Mostly we have children classes from 6 years old until 14.
Okay.
And also the adults from 15 to 80 years old. Even we have 82 years old students here.
Really?
Yes.
And what are they learning?
They're learning English.
Wow. Okay. It's an impressive feat considering Zakaria arrived by boat from Turkey in February with his wife and 5 children. Their boat crashed against the rocks on the beach.
I try to count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I took a deep breath that thanks my God that my children are alive. But unfortunately, we lost 10-year-old girl from another family. And we lost all of our documents, degrees, everything.
By the time Zakaria's family reached Lesvos, Moria was already overcrowded. But since this summer, boat arrivals have increased significantly for the first time in years. There are now more than 17,000 living in a camp with capacity for just over 2,000. In November, the Greek government announced plans to move 20,000 people from the Greek islands to the mainland by early next year and close the camps on Lesvos, Chios and Samos, replacing them with smaller, closed facilities that restrict their freedom of movement. While human rights advocates have long called for people to be moved from the horrendous conditions in Moria, they liken the proposed new facilities to detention centres.
It is not a camp. It's not a refugee camp. It's a prison for them.
Zakaria says he and the other asylum seekers are not criminals. They're not terrorists.
We are not terrorists that they're going to make a detention and a jail for us.
Refugees from Afghanistan make up the biggest group currently on Lesvos, and about 3/4 of them are granted some form of asylum protection. But a few weeks ago, Zakaria and his family were rejected. He says he doesn't know why.
We shocked, actually. For 3 and 5 days, I couldn't go to school, I couldn't go to do my works, and especially my wife was crying.
He says he's working with a lawyer to appeal. Recently, the Greek Prime Minister called for more solidarity from EU member states to help handle the growing migrant crisis. But for the most part, they haven't done much to ease the burden on frontline countries like Greece. Many of them are dealing with an anti-immigrant backlash at home. Zakaria says he's struck by the absence of the Europe he had expected to find here. He wonders, where are the human rights?
We are hurting human rights.
A few weeks ago, Zakaria and his family were moved into a container in a separate, more secure camp a few miles down the road from Moria. They were relatively lucky. Winter is settling on the island, and thousands are still sleeping in tents, including children. Greece has been moving more people to the mainland, but not keeping pace with new arrivals. Zakaria says no one would leave their country if they felt they had a choice. He was fleeing the war.
I left my country that I loved. I left my mom and dad, that they are my life. I left my memories, my good memories, my bad memories. No one wants to leave their countries.
Now, all Zakaria and his family can do is wait. For the world, Holly Young, Moria Camp, Lesvos, Greece.
Tango and Argentina, the dance and the country, are inseparable. Tango is recognized as intangible cultural heritage, according to UNESCO. So is this, as of last week. a plaintive but insistent guitar, a bolero-like rhythm that gets couples swaying and sweating, lyrics that amp up the love and passion on the dance floor. This is the Dominican sound of bachata.
Por tus buenas atenciones, eres bonita aparente.
Luis Segura there, one of the Dominican Republic's greats. He calls himself the father of bachata. Today, that means he's an icon of a style that the UN's Cultural and Education Agency, UNESCO, has designated as intangible cultural heritage. The new list also includes such things as alpine mountain climbing, submitted as a French cultural practice, and Thai massage, which, well, you can get pretty much anywhere around the world. You can hike mountains in a lot of countries, too. Bachata, though, that's Dominican. You're not going to get much argument from anyone about that. Certainly not bachata legend Luis Segura. Washington, Flint, Newark, American cities that have dealt with tainted water. Now add an iconic Canadian ski town to the list, Whistler, British Columbia. A major investigation has found that in many cities across Canada, lead levels in drinking water are dangerously high. Mark Edwards is a leading water scientist based at Virginia Tech. He was the first to expose toxic levels of lead in Flint's water supply. He also specializes in Canada's water issues.
The scale of the problem in Canada is just enormous. You have hundreds, millions of lead pipes out there, and a general lack of corrosion control that tends to make lead in water very, very high in a population that isn't alerted to the problem as yet.
So in Montreal, lead levels are found to be 5 parts per billion or higher. I know you were a main whistleblower in the Flint water crisis. When you look at Montreal, how does that compare to Flint?
The problems that were revealed in this national Canadian investigation showed that hundreds of communities in Canada actually have worse levels of lead than in Flint, Michigan, during the height of the water crisis.
Wow. So when it comes to regulations and standards, what exists in Canada?
In Canada right now, you have national guidelines that are very progressive. They're amongst the toughest lead regulations in the world, but they haven't yet been adopted. And as a result, consumers are thinking that they're better protected than they actually are.
Why haven't they been adopted?
It goes to the provinces, and they can decide whether they want to follow the national guidelines or not, and many of them are choosing not to do that.
So without those regulations and standards, I mean, what is the bar in Canada for safe drinking water?
The bar is what it was 10 years ago, every person for themselves. You know, it's up to you to protect yourself from lead in water. And the tragedy is probably 90% of Canadians don't really have a significant lead in water problem. And so many of them are going to be fearful and spend their money on filters and bottled water when it's not necessary. So that's a tragedy. But it's also tragic that perhaps the 10% of Canadians that have a serious problem aren't fully informed of that risk and perhaps don't know it, and they can't take steps to protect themselves and their families.
What is the root of the problem in Canada, and what's the root of the problem in other parts of the world? Is there a thread?
Yes. This is a government-instigated problem. So the problems of lead pipe arise because governments require them as part of their building code. Lead's a really great plumbing material, except for the fact it kills people and causes disease. And, you know, it lasts a millennia. There's still lead pipes in the ground from Roman times that are capable of carrying water. They don't break, but a little bit of lead in water causes a whole lot of lead poisoning. And as a result, governments just don't want to take responsibility for this problem, and they prefer that consumers not even know about it.
So one place that is not front and center in the findings of this investigation is Toronto, even though historically the city has had some of the highest lead levels in Canada. What is different about Toronto today? What do they do right?
It's quite a success story, actually. When I started consulting on this job about 11 years ago, Toronto had a horrible problem. They had hundreds of thousands of lead pipes, no corrosion control, very high lead in water, and people weren't informed. And while this national conversation has been going on about lead in water, Toronto's implemented very effective corrosion control and I've observed some data that shows lead levels are about 95% lower now as a result. Perhaps there's nothing more annoying than a good example, but they're one.
Investigations like this, I mean, they're helpful, they're informative, but I mean, given how long these problems have been persisting, they can also be frustrating. What frustrates you most when you see reports like this?
It's really the deception. It's our drinking water crises are caused by, first and foremost, a loss of trust. And when consumers discover that they're paying for water that they think is safe, but it's really not, that undermines trust in science, it undermines trust in government, it undermines trust in water, and no one wins from that.
Mark Edwards telling us about the lead contamination in Canada's drinking water. He's based at Virginia Tech. Thanks very much, Mark.
Hang in there.
Everything is connected, certainly in the world of global business. So when Boeing decided to halt production of its 737 MAX jets yesterday, it sent shudders through global supply chains and Boeing's partners, companies that make everything from the metal body of the plane to seat cushions. The 737 MAX was involved in two fatal accidents in Indonesia and Ethiopia over the past 18 months. More than 300 people died. Richard Abulafia is an aircraft industry analyst and vice president of analysis at Teal Group.
This is the country's biggest single manufactured export product. If there really is a cessation of production, not just at Boeing, but in the entire supply chain, which is where the majority of the employment is and the majority of the revenue is, there's no way you could avoid profound consequences. It would definitely be a needle in things as big as GDP or export numbers.
So let's look at that supply chain for the Boeing 737 MAX. When you look at a 737, where are the parts and systems coming from? It? How much of it is made in the U.S. and how much of it is made internationally?
Most Boeing jets were designed and built later on, 80s and 90s and 2000s. And those are the really globalized ones, as you might expect from the entire aircraft industry these days. But the industrial arrangements for the 737 MAX reflect a very 1960s industry, just when the original 737 came out. So it's very heavily American by aircraft industry standards. The body of the plane is built at Spirit AeroSystems in Wichita, Kansas. The engines, even though they're a joint venture with Safran of France and some of the components come from France, the manufacturing line is in Evendale, Ohio. The avionics, the brains of the plane, largely come from U.S. suppliers as well. There are bits and pieces that come from Britain and Japan and Canada and France, but for the most part, it's Boeing's most American jet.
So how will today's news impact those suppliers? Are you already hearing concerns?
Yeah, everyone's quite concerned. There are some suppliers that could be at risk, and Boeing would have a very difficult choice. Either it could preserve its own cash situation, or it could protect them, but probably won't have much choice there because, frankly, you know, the supply chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So you can't let people suffer, and you can't let them lay off people that might be critical when the time comes to ramp production back to the anticipated rate of 52 of these jets per month.
So if you're in the supply chain and you depend on money you would have expected to get from making parts for the 737 MAXs, what are you doing and thinking right about now?
They've got to be very nervous because if they're told, we're stopping, so you're stopping, and we're not paying you anymore, you'd better just coast. And by the way, please keep all of your key people in place to restart in, say, 3 months. That's a tall order for a lot of these contractors that are heavily dependent upon this program and might not have the resources that Boeing does.
What about airlines, the carriers themselves? How will they be impacted by this decision to stop production until April of the 737 MAX?
Well, if indeed that is the date, I mean, we don't have clarity on that either, I'm afraid. But strangely enough, the impact on airlines won't be profound because these planes have been grounded, well, since April, last April anyway. They've been coasting on other aircraft, be it deferred maintenance or deferred retirements or just, you know, capacity cuts here and there. And of course, you know, when the return to service happens, Boeing has 800 jets it needs to get back out there or out there in the first place, 387 that were built then grounded. And since then, they've manufactured 400 more. So in other words, it'll have its hands full.
Boeing is framing this as a temporary halt. I mean, how likely is it that the 737 MAX comes back?
Will it come back? I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, this problem is isolated to one specific system. The jet itself, I don't think there's any doubt that it'll be fine once they get this system dealt with and all the consequences of modifying that system. It's just taking a lot longer than expected.
I mean, it's one system, but there are several hundred dead people from that system and a real reputational hit. I mean, how does Boeing come out of that?
Well, it's going to be difficult, but at the end of the day, this is a 737. It's a mainstay of commercial jet transport, that and the A320. You can't avoid a 737. It's just not possible. Now, can you go out of your way to avoid the MAX? Well, I'm sure there will be people at first who do, and it's going to take time to reestablish confidence.
Richard Abulafia is Vice President of Analysis at Teal Group. That's Market Analysis for Defense and Aerospace Industries. Thank you very much, Richard.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Our final story today is a morality tale set in Moscow. Here's the world's Lucy Martirosian.
Are you the type of person who finds a wallet on the ground and returns it to its rightful owner? Or do you take some of the cash? Well, that's the type of question Anton Belitsky found himself asking when 20,000 rubles suddenly appeared on his Metro card last Friday. 20,000 rubles is about $320.
I thought it was some sort of mistake, so I went over to the information desk at the Metro. The officers laughed at me at first and then told me that it's a faulty card and I should get it checked out.
Now, for some context, a metro ticket typically costs around 38 rubles when traveling in Moscow's central zone. That's 60 cents. Belitsky could have sworn that last time he checked, he only had enough for a few rides. But he didn't have time to sort it out, so he kept traveling. And the card kept working. You know, why fix what's not broken? When he got home, rather than laughing about it over dinner with family, he took to a familiar habit.
I don't know why I have this habit of going on Facebook to write about stuff that happens, but I do.
And a representative from the rail company Moscow Central Diameters, or MCD, saw that Facebook status and asked to meet with him.
The next day we met and he gifted me a new card that already had 1,000 rubles on it. He gave me a tree ornament, two pens, and a portable charger. That was, I guess, for the kindness on my side.
The money was on his card because of a glitch in the system. Belitsky wasn't the only one who accidentally received 20,000 rubles on his card. A few other people did too. Maybe even dozens of others. In any case, MCD, the Moscow rail company, is calling the unexpected money on the card a New Year's miracle. And Moscow transport officials say people who experience the glitch can keep the extra credit. That is, besides Belitsky, who already exchanged his card.
Why did I give up the money? That's my favorite question. In the last 2 days, I've been reading the news about me and this situation. And so many people are writing about how I am an idiot. How could I give up 20,000 rubles for 1,000 rubles?
But Belitsky is an honest and cautious guy. He didn't want any trouble down the line. And all those people who got to keep their money? It's not clear that they actually did. I reached out to Moscow's rail company, MCD, but I didn't hear back. For The World, I'm Lucy Martirosian.
That's our last stop on the show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.